50 Years of Saving Lives, the book. Narrated by Mike Fronczek.
Chapter 1, The 60s. America breaks free of its moorings, the protracted murder of hope. At the beginning of the 1960s, America was completely different than it is today. In 1960, abortion was nearly unheard of. In fact, for the vast majority of Americans, abortion was unthinkable. After that brief introduction, there is a pull quote at the beginning of Chapter 1, which reads, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair." With apologies to the venerable Charles Dickens and his classic A Tale of Two Cities, it seemed that 1960s America looked ever so much like A Tale of Two Countries. The nation was rife with controversies and contradictions. In nearly every cultural precinct, resentments once simmering beneath the surface were boiling over into the public square in open conflict. It was the traditional button-down establishment versus America's youth, many of whom identified with the long-haired, hippie or beat generation. In myriad ways, Wisconsin's history with abortion and right-to-life activism mirrors our national history on these topics. To understand what happened in Wisconsin, one must take a wider view and understand what happened in our nation at large. The 60s in the U.S. were tumultuous years of transformational change. Calm had given way to upheaval. Foundational mores crumbled. Instead of regarding parents as role models and protectors, the children of the 60s saw them as hopelessly square, out-of-touch killjoys. The up-and-coming baby boom generation was running on rebellion, radical ideas, and rock and roll. The oft-repeated slogan, "Don't trust anyone over 30," spoke to young America's disillusionment with the established systems of life in these United States. This profound sense of disillusionment ushered in a great winter of discontent and unrest. Many suggest the genesis of this social upheaval occurred during the dark, waning days of autumn 1963, when President John F. Kennedy, his youth and vigor, the very personification of hopefulness for many Americans, was shot dead in Dallas, Texas. As TV screens flickered with the horrific images of November 22nd, it seemed that the assassin's rounds had shattered more than the president's skull. Something basic to all our lives was shattered that day. Something intrinsic to the American psyche. Hope. And if hope wasn't dead, it was certainly on life support. No one observing the great American ship of state in 1963 could have predicted what would happen next. The cultural backlash occurring in the wake of JFK's death overturned and unearthed our nation's prevailing opinion on nearly everything. Springing to life from this fertile soil of tumult was a strange hybrid variety of human relationship, something called free love. But, as will be seen, this type of love was anything but free. The panoply of historic events, seismic political and academic shifts, as well as the conversion of the media and entertainment industries into a mouthpiece for liberal values, was unprecedented. America was facing a crucible. When it would emerge, its cultural appearance would be radically altered. By the end of the 60s, Kenneth Walsh writes, Americans had lost much of their innocence and optimism. Some young people turned violent in their effort to fight, quote, the system, end quote. Few events were as pivotal as the escalating Vietnam War, which was taking the lives of thousands of American soldiers and countless Vietnamese every year. Americans increasingly believed that their leaders, civilian and military, had falsely persuaded them that the war was worth fighting and was winnable. But the shocking events of 1968 brought a tectonic shift. On January 31, the Vietnamese communists launched the Tet Offensive, which surprised the Americans and their Saigon allies and created havoc across South Vietnam. The attackers absorbed heavy losses, but their ferocity and daring made a deep impression on the American public. The offensive suggested that a U.S. victory in Indochina was many years and thousands of lives away, if it could ever be achieved. On April 4, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, sparking riots in Washington, Chicago, Baltimore, and many other places. Quote, for liberals, even for many black militants and radicals, he was the last black hope, end quote, wrote sociologist Todd Gitlin. Quote, when he was murdered, it seemed that nonviolence went to the grave with him, and the movement was free at last from restraint, end quote. On June 5, Robert Kennedy was shot after winning the Democratic presidential primary in California that day. He died June 6. Quote, to think about the enormous repercussions of the assassinations of 1968, Gitlin wrote, we need to backtrack to the imagery and mood of a more general Armageddon, for which the triggering moment is the assassination of 1963. Kennedy, King, Kennedy. They sometimes felt like stations in one protracted murder of hope. In late August 1968, thousands of anti-war, anti-establishment demonstrators clashed with police at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. This sent televised images of violence and anger to the world and raised the possibility that America was undergoing a nervous breakdown. It is the extremes that stand out most starkly today. Quote, the left blazed through the 60s like a meteor, reshaping the cultural landscape, particularly in the areas of gender and race, end quote. Historians Maurice Isserman and Michael Kazin wrote in America Divided, The Civil War of the 1960s. Meanwhile, they add, quote, the right established itself as a unified and potent political movement during the same decade, end quote. Much has been made of the left's impact, but conservatives planted seeds for the future too. The right's goals included preserving social and moral order, promoting traditional values such as family, patriotism, and the work ethic, and encouraging self-reliance, distrust of government, and a tough stand against communism or international wrongdoers. Those sentiments still inform and animate conservatism today. In 1969, the duality of American life, the innocence juxtaposed with cynicism, the promise contrasted with the failure, became more clear than ever. Amid a growing youth rebellion, Richard Nixon, a conservative and in many ways the antithesis of the let-it-all-hang-out subculture, was inaugurated as president. But in another reflection of polarization, nearly 500,000 young people gathered that summer on a 600-acre farm in New York for the Woodstock Music Festival, a 3-day concert and celebration of music, peace, and love that they hoped would demonstrate a new way of living for the future. And there ends the long quote from Kenneth Walsh. And now returning to the original writings in the book, 50 Years of Saving Lives. Woodstock. Iconic 60s folk artist Joni Mitchell sang of Woodstock in her tune of the same name, recalling in dreamlike metaphor that because of all the music and singing and love at the landmark music festival, somehow American bombers in Vietnam had turned into butterflies over our nation. By the time nearly 500,000 young people showed up at Max Yasger's dairy farm near White Lake, New York, to celebrate 3 days of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, not to mention a lot of mud, the wholesale rejection of traditional American values had reached its zenith. To gauge the pulse of one half of our divided nation in 1969, one needed only to listen to the music of Woodstock. With dark, caustic humor, Country Joe McDonald, himself a Navy vet, wrote and performed the anti-war song, lamenting that the protracted and unpopular Vietnam conflict, its official name, could be blamed on politicians and military leaders who forced thousands of young men to go face death. As McDonald sarcastically sang, "Whoopee, we're all gonna die." Laced into Woodstock's music were the billows of a blossoming drug culture, with Arlo Guthrie imploring the customs inspector to please don't touch my bag, and the Airplane's Grace Slick suggesting that with one pill, all logic and proportion have fallen sloppy dead. You are listening to a reading of Chapter 1 from the Wisconsin Right to Life 50th Anniversary publication, 50 Years of Saving Lives. Young America had observed what their elders had done as leaders of the country and were shaken to the core. Their profound disappointment would be salved with the comfort of doing whatever felt good to escape the pain and darkness of whatever did not. Sexual Revolution. Woodstock's music and the radical revolutionary message of the 60s, in general, thoroughly permeated American radio, TV, and film with almost post-apocalyptic overtones. The nation seemed to be diving headlong into an anarchistic, dystopian existence where authority at all levels was rejected, while self-absorbed pleasure-seeking was widely accepted. Young people across all socioeconomic strata began experimenting with marijuana and psychedelic drugs. Instead of facing sad, monochrome reality, many found tripping 8 miles high on a drug-addled escape to Ichiku Park was far better. After all, everything there was colorful, mellow, and, quote, all too beautiful, end quote. So beautiful it could make one cry. Dark, angry protest songs and flower power free love lyrics made the early Elvis Presley hip gyrations and subtly suggestive lyrics seem tame compared to what pop music had devolved into. In 1965, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels released the song C.C. Ryder, the title itself a sound-alike variation on Easy Rider, slang for a sexual partner. The tune's lyrics, "Jenny, Jenny, Jenny, won't you take a ride with me," pounded barely veiled sexual innuendo into mainstream American radio play. Explicit poetry put to music became so commonplace that the FBI spent 2 years investigating whether or not the top 40 hit song by the Kingsmen, Louie Louie, contained lyrics which were indecent and therefore banned from airplay. John Lennon of the Beatles was burned in effigy after making an offhanded remark to the press bemoaning the fact that church attendance was down while he and his bandmates were reaching such meteoric heights as to have eclipsed the popularity of Jesus Christ. As it happened, Lennon accurately recognized the cultural shift that was underway, ironically, with his help. Those in the media, academia, and politics who embraced a left-leaning agenda grasped the importance and strategic value of the restless 60s, seeing it as a golden opportunity to advance the liberal and/or progressive agenda. As Bob Dylan sang in 1964, "The times, they are a-changin'." Those intent on liberalizing our country did so, they said, to unchain us from the bondage of puritanical sexual repression. On closer examination, however, there may have been ulterior political motivations at work tied to the left's holy grail of undoing capitalism as America's chief economic engine. For so-called evil businesses to thrive and profit, they had to maintain control of their workforce. Puritanical sexual restraint was necessary, it was thought, so the working class would keep their minds on building widgets and not drift off on flights of fancy. Seeking a more revolutionary outcome, some liberals believed that the sexual revolution could help spell the demise of exploitive, profit-motivated businesses and fat cats. This would mean the people would be set free. There is more than a little irony to be found in recognizing the profit-driven position maintained by what is today the largest abortion provider in America, Planned Parenthood. It is clear their supporters feel free to justify capitalism in this particular case. Whatever the motivations and goals of those fanning the flames of the sexual revolution, it didn't take long for it to take hold. The long-held American double standard that seemed to excuse young men to sow their wild oats while enforcing a strict code of chastity for young women ultimately gave in to the pressure, rocking and rolling its way across the USA as a perfect storm of newfound sexual freedom. Quote, in 1960, half of unmarried 19-year-old women had not yet had sex, writes Nancy Cohen. In the late 1980s, half of all American girls engaged in sexual intercourse by the age of 17, two-thirds by the age of 18. The pornification of America. When the New York Times asked Playboy magazine founder Hugh Hefner what made him most proud about his so-called contributions to American society and culture, he said, quote, that I changed attitudes toward sex, that nice people can live together now, that I decontaminated the notion of premarital sex. That gives me great satisfaction. End quote. Often cited as the father and later the grandfather of the sexual revolution, Hefner passed away at age 91 in September of 2017, having blazed the sad, hedonistic trail for the pornification of America. Sporting the iconic Playboy Bunny logo, coyly conveying the obvious innuendo, Hefner began his magazine on $8,000 raised from 45 investors in 1953. Camille Paglia noted that, quote, Hefner's new vision of American masculinity was part of his desperate revision of his own Puritan heritage. On his father's side, Paglia wrote, he descended directly from William Bradford, who came over on the Mayflower and was governor of Plymouth Colony, the major settlement of New England Puritans. Often pictured in pajamas or a silk smoking jacket and smoking a pipe, Hefner personally promoted the Playboy philosophy as the magazine became an amalgam of nude photographs of gorgeous women and intellectual writing. "I just read Playboy for the articles," was a standard, if joking, line at the time. "Part of the reason that I am who I am is that my Puritan roots run deep," Hefner told the Associated Press in 2011. "My folks are Puritan. My folks are prohibitionists. There was no drinking in my home, no discussion of sex. And I think I saw the hurtful and hypocritical side of that from very early on." If you had to sum up the idea of Playboy, it is anti-Puritanism, he was quoted as saying, as the country's mood became more hedonistic. Quote, "not just in regard to sex," he said, "but the whole range of play and pleasure." Hefner's influence cannot be understated. It was landmark. His magazine helped normalize out-of-wedlock sexual behavior once considered forbidden by both men and women. By the end of the 60s, it was seen by many to be avant-garde and sophisticated to have multiple sexual partners. What was once the scarlet letter was now a badge of achievement. Especially in the 60s, the Playboy image became mainstream American fare. It was new and cool, while marriage and monogamy were being rebranded as old-fashioned and repressive. The paradigm had shifted. Now it was sophisticated and somehow liberating to objectify women solely as playthings, as agents of visual and physical pleasure. No longer did men need to see women as whole persons, as bearers of the Imago Dei, with intrinsic God-imbued worth, not to mention their unique potential as lifetime marriage partners and mothers. After all, went the thinking in the 60s, if suave, debonair James Bond could be a serial philanderer, why not everyone else? And that's all the time we have for this episode. We'll be back next time with more.